Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On September 14th, 1991, in Anchorage, Alaska, a very pregnant Peggy Barnett, along with her 9-year-old daughter, drove to the post office to deliver a package to an associate, George Kerr, in Chugiak, 15 miles outside of Anchorage. George's father, David Kerr, picked up the package 3 days later and brought it home. He and his wife, Michelle, were in the kitchen when David opened the package. The explosion was so intense, neighbors feared there had been an earthquake. David died instantly, but Michelle survived. Michelle told U.S. Postal Inspectors that Doug Gustafson was involved. It was no secret that Douglas Gustafson and his cohort Raymond Cheely despised George Kerr, had knowledge of explosives, and liked to blow things up. However, they had perfect alibis. They were already in prison for murder. An investigative task force was formed led by U.S. Postal Inspection Service with assistance from the Anchorage Police Department and the U.S. Department of the Treasury, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, ATF, to solve this case. The book we're featuring this evening is The Alaska Mail Bomb Conspiracy, with my special guest, the legendary Burl Bear. Welcome to the program, and thank you for very much for agreeing to this interview, the legendary Burl Bear.
Yes, a living legend in my own mind. Always a pleasure to be on your program, Dan, and I'm going to practice being very stoic today to fit
yes.
in with the Canadian vibratory pattern.
Yes, it's not Canadian, but it emanates from a Canadian, so thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Burl, and let's talk about this Alaska mail bomb conspiracy. How did it come that you were involved with this? Why this story? What was, tell us some of the details.
Well, how did I get this one? How did I get so lucky?
Yes.
Well, it goes back to the book I did immediately before I started this. Now, even though the Alaska mail bomb conspiracy came out fairly recently, I started what was going to be a full-length book a long time ago, over 20 years. It was the book that I was doing immediately after Man Overboard, The Counterfeit Resurrection of Phil Champagne, and doing it for the same publisher, Northwest Publishing. And it was during my investigation of Man Overboard that I met the United States Postal Inspectors who were involved in that case as well. They're the ones who told me about this horrific, just absolutely awful, awful case of this mail bomb conspiracy and what it took to solve it. And I thought this was absolutely fascinating, and I did a proposal for the book. We cut a good deal, and I started working on it. And I'll tell you, the U.S. Postal Inspectors were so thrilled to be having a book done about them, because even in the United States of America, where people are so astute and knowledgeable of government issues, people were totally ignorant of the U.S. Postal Inspectors. In fact, Jim Bordenay, who I must credit with being absolutely fantastic in his help in putting this thing together, he made sure that this book or audio book, however you want to call it, is 100% factual. I mean, he made sure I made no mistakes. And if I did, he made me correct him. So,
right.
You know, you're getting the real deal story here. But he brought this to my attention, and we started working on it. And then I didn't get paid. And I didn't get paid the next month or the next. And they called and said, Burl, how's this book going on, the U.S. Postal Inspectors? And I said, Well, here's the problem. I haven't been paid in about 2 or 3 months, and that's kind of brought everything to a screaming halt. Well, I went fishing for a couple of weeks with my kids up at Loon Lake, Washington, and I got back and there was a fax on my fax machine. Remember those? I had a fax machine, and there was a message from the U.S. Postal Inspectors saying, "Dear Mr. Bear, you will appreciate this press release. Agents of the United States Postal Inspection Service, or office, whatever the heck they're called, raided the offices of Northwest Publishing, confiscated their computers, and they went down. Turns out the true crime was allegedly the publisher and his son, who allegedly were spending the money rather than paying the bills. I think it was something like $3 million in corporate checks cashed at the Money Tree in the mall, paying over $250,000 in check cashing fees. So for a while, the Alaska mail bomb conspiracy was one of the assets of the company that was in the litigation, and it took a few years for me to get the material back and the rights back because it was considered an asset of the company. Then what am I going to do with it? Well, several years later, let's fast forward to the wonderful author and editor, R. Barry Flowers, got a hold of me and asked if I would... Yes, go ahead. Did you say something there, Dan?
No, sorry. No, I was just saying yes, R. Barry Flowers, yes.
Yeah, R. Barry Flowers, who he cranks out books faster than I can read them in a variety of genres. He said, "Burl, would you like to be a master of true crime?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to be the master of something, and slavery is no longer legal." So sure, because I got to be in a rarefied atmosphere of, you know, all these really great true crime writers. So I figured I was snuck in there somehow, you know, a mercy credit. And so I couldn't pass that up. Well, then what was I going to do? Well, I already had all the research on the Alaska mail bomb conspiracy. And I found I still had Jim Bourdonnais' phone number tucked away somewhere. And even though he'd retired, he's still well connected within the department and had all the information. And he volunteered to help me make sure I got it right and got it accurate. And we launched into this thing, and I'm really happy with the way it came out. Now, while it's shorter than a traditional true crime book, I've always had the feeling, in fact, Frank Girardo and I put this in writing, I think, or we said it out loud, when we did the book A Taste for Murder and Betrayal in Blue, and that is to put a mandatory word count on a true crime book isn't really rational. Because if you have to do 100,000 words on a story that takes 80,000 to tell it really well, what are you doing with the other 20,000 words? And that's always bothered me. It's like when you read a really fast-moving mystery, such as, say, mine, that no one buys, my novel Headlock, it's going to check in between 55,000 and maybe 65,000 tops. You know, he said, "What a good, quick read, perfect for the beach." But sometimes you go start out on a true crime, or what they call them now, nonfiction thrillers. You find yourself reading the reviews and go, "Oh, I'm sure he padded this with unnecessary facts. We don't need those. Just tell us who killed who and have lots of pictures." So Frank and I decided on that book, let's just write the book, and when we've told the story, we've told the story. And we did very well with that. And I think this is kind of the same theory on this. This book, this could have been expanded to whatever word count anybody wanted, because it was, let me tell you, how extreme this was in the investigation. And I'll tell you a little bit about the crime, too. That would be helpful. But almost everybody in the state of Alaska was wiretapped. And I'm not exaggerating. They did get federal authorization to wiretap almost everybody in Alaska that could possibly have any connection to any of the people that they thought may have been involved, and they didn't know who may have been involved. So that meant everybody. So it was a process of elimination. If we can eliminate as many people as humanly possible, then we can get down to who may have committed this absolutely horrifying crime. Now, you mentioned that Michelle survived. I think there have been many times when she wished she hadn't. Not only was her husband killed and her house destroyed, her face was melted. Her eyes were filled with glass. The most horrifying, excruciating pain for this woman, not only physically, but emotionally, psychologically, financially. I'm sure there were many times when she wished she'd been a thing forgotten quite. Very, very tragic. And no one was trying to kill her. No one was trying to kill her husband. The two people, or actually it comes down to about three or four, responsible for this horrible crime, were trying to kill a cute little puppy dog, George, the teenage boy, or, you know, young adult boy, because they were mad at him because he testified against them in their murder trial. And so they decided to kill him from prison. And Peggy, the sister, pregnant, as you mentioned, drove to the post office over a very bumpy road, could have been induced labor right there on the spot, and for $2.22, mails death and destruction to the home of George and his father and stepmom. Really horrible. I mean, they found his knuckles on the roof. That's how powerful that explosion was. And it was just a horrifying thing. So ask me something and I'll answer it.
Let's go back to the characters responsible here, the main characters, and the ones you paint a very vivid portrait of, Raymond Smiley Cheely, and you can tell us why they call him Smiley, and Douglas Lizard Gustafson. You tell us when they meet,
the names
when
kind
they're
of
young.
Give you a hint. To say Raymond Smiley Cheely and Douglas Lizard Gustafson are neither bright men nor endearing characters. They're convicted teenage murderers. Now, Cheely's nickname derives from his continual grin. He looks as happy just as if he had brains. Gustafson earned his reputation by his lack of human warmth. Naturally, they became the best of friends. They went to Chugiak High School, a well-known educational institution, where they dissipated their mid-teen years in repeated displays of antisocial behavior. And they had a bunch of buddies that hung out with them. There was Travis and Eric and this guy and that guy. And they did all sorts of typical fun teenage things like blowing up mailboxes. You know, there's not too much to do in Chugiak. Everyone liked Cheely because he had a big Suburban and he'd organize parties. He could get a lot of people in that Suburban. And they were also known for as the Burn Brothers because they used to put out their cigarettes in their arms. Apparently a shortage of ashtrays in Chugiak.
Sure.
They did that to show they were tough or nuts. We're both one of the two. They were fairly fearless. They would rob places, do all sorts of stupid stuff. They would get arrested or get in trouble for things, but they were juveniles, and you can't do too much to them, you know. You don't want to, because what's the law enforcement theory? If a juvenile delinquent can make it to the age of 24, you got nothing more to worry about. Because usually by then, they've either grown up or they've got married, and that'll usually slow them down tremendously when they've got a ball and chain. If it's not the prison, it's the spouse. So that usually takes care of them. But what Cheely, not Raymond Cheely, but rather Lizard Gustafson, if someone gave me the nickname Lizard, I wouldn't be that pleased, but apparently it didn't bother him. He always wanted to be a sniper, whether officially or unofficially. So he mail-ordered, I believe, a nice sniper rifle. And of course, what's a kid going to do with a rifle like that except use it recklessly? I mean, apparently they didn't take very many gun safety courses, or if they did, they totally ignored them. They're driving along in the car. Smiley is driving. Lizard is in the passenger seat. And little George is in the back seat. Lizard has his brand new weapon, and he decides he's going to fire it. And so he does. That sniper rifle arrived October 19th, 1990. And they had a fun evening set up. They had some prostitutes meeting them at a motel where they're all just going to, you know, smoke dope and have sex, which sounds perfectly fine to me, except that on the way to this little party, Lizard decides he's going to take a pot shot with the rifle. And he does. The bullet comes out of the rifle, goes through the rear window of another car, and kills this kid in, I don't mean a little kid, but, you know, a young man, in the passenger seat. Now, that's fairly shocking right there.
Yeah. You talk about this Jeffrey Cain. He was the passenger who was shot, but they don't stop, and they don't realize that they've actually killed anyone, despite targeting this car that they used a premise that they had cut him off. So they
shot
him.
Yeah, that's a good reason. Every time someone cuts me off in a car, Lord knows I get out a sniper rifle.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So they don't realize immediately and that they've actually killed this guy till George Kerr the next morning reads the paper. What does he read in the paper, and then what does he decide to do?
Well, he has more ethics and brains than the other two put together. The next morning, he gets up. He has to get to work, gets a cab home, and sees the morning newspaper. And he realizes that Gustafson hadn't missed. He calls the guys at the motel, told them what happened. They told him to keep his damn mouth shut. Well, he figured if he didn't take immediate action to protect himself, his life and future were in immediate danger, because he was in the car when the gun was fired. Hanging out with teenage tough guys is one thing, but murder is something else entirely. And that's when he told his boss what happened. Now, by sheer coincidence, his boss's attorney was there at the same time, and he told the kid to go to the police and do it immediately. So he did. And he told the cops everything and agreed to wear a hidden recorder to tape incriminating conversations with Sheila Gustafson. So while David Kerr thought his son was at work, he was really out with the police getting wired up. Long story short, he got them on wire, you know, blatantly talking about killing, shooting, either intentionally or unintentionally, this Jeffrey Cain fellow. And the media attention on this, as you can imagine, was beyond extensive. It was Anchorage's first drive-by shooting, and, you know, I mean, what else you got to talk about up there, you know? It became really a big story.
You have a scene in this story, though, again, very movie-esque, where Chile was at the house of George Kerr.
Oh, yeah.
And, with his dad. And so they were there to make sure, they were on a premise there that they needed David to help them with their vehicle, but really was there, you write, that it was really basically there to make sure he didn't rat out. And at the same time, tell us what was happening while they were there to ensure he didn't rat out.
Yeah, well, David Kerr thought his son was at work. George was really with the cops. Finally, he calls his dad, explaining what happened the night before and how he planned to help the police. Now, as you say, when George called his dad, he had no idea that Chile was right there at the house. Chile was obviously there to make sure that George had rolled over on him. And, you know, like you say, they made up this nonsense story about needing help repairing the truck. Well, here's his dad standing there listening to his son tell him about this murder while the perpetrators are standing right there next to him. So he has to do his best to cover up what he's saying, what the conversation is about, without tipping off Chile that George has already gone to the cops. Now, as a precaution, the cops sent George to talk to Doug Gustafson. Meanwhile, the police contacted everyone on the fringe of Chile's shrinking gang and got all of them to wear wires. So everybody's recording everybody else, and the feds authorized wiretaps on everybody in Alaska's phone. I mean, this comes up later, you know. This comes up after the kid, puppy dog George's attempted murder, when his father is killed and his stepmom is melted. So you've got this big story, big trial. Chile and Gustafson are sent to prison for life. Now, this doesn't stop Chile from grinning constantly, and it doesn't stop Lizard from being cold. But Chile puts together a hit list of everybody he's going to get even with. And he's going to kill him. He's going to blow him up. He's going to do something horrible to him. Everyone from the judge to the prosecutor, but most of all, who they most despise, who they most hate, is George, little George, puppy dog George, cute kid. They want to kill him more than anything because he ratted him out. And he did it smartly and he did it immediately. Well, and the question is how do you get a mail bomb? How do you make it? How do you mail it? And how do you kill your victim? Well, they did everything except the last part. They killed, can't say the wrong people because it's not right to kill people, but they killed George's father and destroyed the life pretty darn much of his stepmom.
Michelle, when she was questioned by Anchorage police and by later by the inspectors, U.S. Postal inspectors, the task force, she somehow knew and thought and was adamant that it was Doug Gustafson.
Doug Gustafson,
yeah. Was responsible.
Well, because it was no secret that Gustafson and Chile absolutely hated little George because he was the kid that, you know, was in the back seat when they pulled the trigger. He'd been with him, you know, the night before, partying at the motel. And they figured, well, boy, better make sure George doesn't rat us out on this. He's got to keep his mouth shut. Well, George didn't keep his mouth shut. He told the truth. And they didn't blame themselves for what resulted in this innocent guy's death that they shot on a highway, but they blamed George for talking about it. And so their big revenge was to kill him. And the way they were going to do it is a mail bomb.
You write that 2 hours after the explosion, the investigative task force was formed. We mentioned in the introduction, Anchorage Police Department, U.S. Department of Treasury, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF. And Inspector Russell Mabry is task force leader.
Mm-hmm.
They spent a couple of weeks at the crime scene to establish that this was an actual, what found materials that you can only find at Radio Shack. So they had all kinds of forensic evidence.
Oh, yeah.
But they also, you talk about an Inspector Matthew Allen. We all know that that most, or I think all, prison will record phone calls. But
all
in this case, nobody
calls are recorded. But that doesn't mean anybody listens to them.
Yeah.
Therein lies the crux of the matter. This guy must have had the patience of two saints because he sits and he listens to hours upon hours upon hours of banal, boring, useless prisoner phone conversations. Chile, Gustafson, not saying anything. I mean, I got to tell you, I had in my possession, thanks to the United States Postal Inspectors, they gave me absolutely everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. I received this giant box of transcripts of wiretaps on these characters.
Wow.
Now, just listening to their conversations is bad enough, but reading them, if you have any command of the language, is a horrifying experience. I'm at a loss for words. As a wordsmith, I'm at a loss for words. I got so tired of a four-letter word that begins with F and ends with K that if I never saw that word again in my entire life, I'd be perfectly happy. Every word was prefaced with some form of that. So it was like George Carlin does a comedy routine on how useful that word is. It could be a noun, a verb, an adjective, an adverb. They used it in ways even Carlin never imagined. And I tell you, their conversations were as blunt as their vocabulary, devoid of any depth. And it was just even to read it. I mean, you didn't have to get too deep. I mean, these guys weren't famous for the use of metaphors. It was all right there, you know. But every other word was an expletive. It just like rained on you constantly. So this is an example of how cooperative everybody was in this case with me. And one reason for that, aside from the fact they wanted the story told and told well, was that the U.S. Postal Inspection Service hadn't been the subject of anything since 1949 movie Post Office Investigator, starring, I can't remember what the male lead was, but Audrey Long was the female lead, and she was the wife, became wife, of Leslie Charteris, author of The Saint. See what a small world it is.
Yes, it is.
So that was kind of an interesting little tie in there. But, I mean, they were really aggravated. I think Jim Bourdonnais, when we were first talking about doing this book, he said, I was watching the news, and it said, FBI agents, aided by postal workers, raided the office of such and such. And it sounded like you visualize, you know, these mail carriers rushing in, pulling machine guns out of their mailbags. Well, no.
Yeah.
United States Postal Inspection Service has a bigger and better lab than the FBI. That usually doesn't occur to people. The U.S. Postal Inspector's Investigative Service is state-of-the-art everything. They're really beyond the FBI, or at least they were at the time. Now, here's a shocking little thing that I uncovered that most people don't know. In the 1990s, early 1990s, I can't remember who was head of the FBI then. Comey, I think, may have been. Or Mueller, I can't recall. One of the two. The average teenager in America had more computer power in their bedroom than the FBI had altogether. The FBI still didn't have computers with hard drives. They had like, you know, Franklin Ace 1200 OMS, you know, with a CPM on floppies. This is what the FBI had because there hadn't been a budgetary allocation for computers for the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? They had to bring in someone from the computer industry, which they did, to testify before Congress. It was imperative that the United States come up with the money to buy the FBI computers, in fact, computers with hard drives, and computers that had a mouse. I mean, that's what the state was technologically of our FBI in the early 1990s. So there had to be a lot of upgrades to the FBI. That's a little sidebar story there that you might find of interest because we always think of the FBI as being state-of-the-art. Well, the art of the state hadn't kept up with the state-of-the-art whatsoever at that time.
With this Inspector Matthew Allen from the U.S. Postal Inspector Investigative Task Force, on September 5th, he discovered in 1991, 12 days before the explosion, Gustafson called Peggy, giving instructions about fixing her car. What did he find by listening to that transcript or reading that transcript and listening to that phone call? What did he determine those instructions actually were?
Okay, I think I got it right here, as a matter of fact. I wrote the book. This isn't because of my perfect memory. It's because I've got the book here. Alan called in Inspectors Mabry and Pollack. The more they listened, the more they learned. The conspiracy to murder Kerr involved Peggy, Doug, their brother Craig, Raymond Cheeley, a mutual friend, Joseph Ryan. Doug told Peggy that when it was all done, he'd sit back in his cell, quote, smoke a nice juicy cigar, down a glass of spirits, and laugh so hard. That's not a good sign. Now, the phone recordings also reveal Peggy's erotic dream in which she kills George with her bare hands after hitting him with her car. Excerpt was actually included in the original charging documents filed against Peggy, which formed the basis for her initial arrest. It was a pretty wild end. You know, I started off the book with that dream where she, because
yes.
It was really weird, because she's telling her brother about this erotic dream she has where she hits George on purpose with her car, and then he's laying there on the gravel with blood coming out of his mouth, and she breaks his neck with her bare hands, and she's got blood on her hands, and she almost has an orgasm telling this story, and so does her brother. He just loves to listen. But he reminds
wow.
her, he says, gotta be careful about the blood. After all, we're Jehovah's Witnesses. We got to watch out for that blood.
Yeah,
and they
okay.
were Jehovah's Witnesses, as a matter of fact. No bad reflection on the witnesses. They don't need Peggy and Doug reflecting on them, I'm sure.
You talk about, too, that once they, from this phone line and from some of the things, incriminating things that Peggy said and other people said, and you say there was not just George Kerr's wiretap, and that was very effective getting incriminating evidence. There was also other wiretap evidence presented at this trial. There was also another person named Joseph Ryan. What was his role in this? And tell us a little bit about what happened with him.
Poor Joseph Ryan. I can't figure this one out. This is one for the legal books, and I'm sure it's referenced somewhere. In fact, Aaron Moriarty, who does the CBS 48 Hours, she was a guest on my show a few times. And
right.
I said, Aaron, can you imagine a case where someone is found guilty and sentenced to 50-some months in prison for a crime they've never been charged with? She says, no, that's impossible. And I said, well, you got to meet Joseph Ryan. Joseph Ryan had absolutely, virtually nothing to do with this. He was just a buddy of Cheeley's. They said, hey, you go over to the yard, kind of like that. If you've ever been to Alaska or Eastern Washington, not much difference. You got people who've got yards, they've got cars and trucks and all sorts of stuff, you know, out there,
yeah.
And pick up a couple of these items for me that are mine that are stored over there. And, just individual items. There's some, blasting caps and, nothing illegal. And yet, he was found guilty of possession of, illegal firearm possession. He was never charged with it. The jury came back and, he was found innocent of everything, but still sentenced to 50-some months in prison for a crime that he was never charged with. That is unique in the annals of American law. Now, you'd think that he would get paid minimum wage for every hour he spent in prison after being found innocent and a letter of apology. This did go to the appeals court. The court of appeals said, yes, this is a really ridiculous error, but we don't care. We'll just let it slide, which isn't very, substantive support of our legal system where people can be found guilty of crimes they've never been charged with. But it happened absolutely positively. Now, of course, Peggy actually did have very direct involvement.
Sure.
Aside from it, there's no crime to have erotic dreams about murdering someone or listening to them. But knowing that you're delivering a mail bomb, That's culpability for sure. And she knew. She knew exactly what she was delivering. She knew what it was supposed to accomplish. And she thought it was an absolutely wonderful idea.
What was Craig's role in the bomb making and delivery?
Okay, I got to refresh my memory here. It's been more than a week or two since since I wrote the book. But he was going to cooperate, I believe, the other brother. But he came up with a brilliant idea. He ran away.
Yeah.
He ran away from Alaska. And, you know, what's interesting is that in the United States, if someone is involved in murder or another heinous crime, almost without exception, guess where they run away to? Can you guess?
Where?
Las Vegas, Nevada. For
right.
some reason, people believe that if you go to Las Vegas, no one will find you. That's not true. As a matter of fact, following some murders where the person vanishes, they know what they're looking for, they will send detectives first and foremost to Las Vegas, Nevada, because they know people think they can go to Las Vegas and not be found. It's not that big a city, for heaven's sakes. Serial killers will travel cross-country to go to Las Vegas to get caught. And people also think they can take counterfeit money or counterfeit money orders to Las Vegas and no one's going to notice, not really realizing that the United States Secret Service has the biggest office in Las Vegas, Nevada. You know, law enforcement's, you know, they may have a IQ cap in some local departments, but when it comes to federal agents, you're talking about some pretty smart people.
Yeah.
Anyway, he runs off not to Las Vegas, but to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And this is where, again, it gets very strange. This is like something exactly right out of a movie. He calls back home to his wife or girlfriend, whatever she is,
yeah,
and says, there's a, what was it, a $10,000 reward for his
yeah.
capture.
Right.
So he tells his girlfriend, I want you to get the reward. So turn me in and get the money. Well, she keeps him on the phone long enough for them to trace the call, and they trace it to the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood, California, which is fairly close to Grauman's Chinese Theater, as a matter of fact. And there's a movie being filmed at the Roosevelt. At that time, the technical advisor to the motion picture happens to be good buddies with the real law enforcement officer who comes crashing in to arrest the kid who's calling from the phone booth, but they have to pass through the movie set to get to him, and the advisor on the movie thinks it's a practical joke. But they really are there with guns drawn to arrest somebody,
yeah.
and that's the kid in the phone booth. So that was a very, very strange scene, as you can imagine. Now, that was on, March 12th, I guess. Well, that's when Craig Gustafson called and confessed of his role. But they didn't arrest him right away, and they hadn't arrested him until he was down here in Hollywood. In fact, none of these people were arrested. Now, you might say, why weren't they arrested? Well, a couple reasons. They wanted to keep their options open on who all was involved in this conspiracy, and it was a conspiracy, not like some of the ones that people make up. But, I mean, this was a real one. And they weren't sure all who were involved. Also, investigations of this nature are horrifyingly expensive. Cost a fortune. Who is going to pick up the tab for this? The police in Chugiak, the police in law enforcement in Anchorage, or the federal government? Well, who's going to pay for everything? This is a big issue, and as I'm sure you recall, the reason why your wonderful serial killer up there in Vancouver, the guy with the hog farm,
Dixon, yes,
and the reason they didn't go after him, even though they knew it was him and they knew what was going on, was because, well, they had three reasons. They said, well, we can't afford it. We don't know what we're doing is number three. And we're not trained in doing this, so we'll let it slide.
Sure.
You know, after all, who cares how many people get murdered? We just can't afford this. Well, finally,
yeah.
I believe the wise Canadian government coughed up some cosmic cash to pay for the investigation, very similar to what happened in Spokane with the investigation of the Spokane serial killer, which dragged on longer practically than reruns of I Love Lucy. Millions and millions of dollars. Finally, the U.S. government had come up with $8 million, I believe, to pay the expenses of the Homicide Task Force. People don't stop and realize how expensive these coordinated investigations are. So there was an agreement made between the feds, the federal agencies, and the local investigators that they will all work together, but the feds would handle the actual arrests, prosecution, etc. So you have these several federal agencies involved, as you mentioned, and they didn't really come out and arrest anybody or press charges until they had all their proverbial culprits together. And there was a change of venue. I mean, I can certainly understand that, is how in the world are these guys and girls and men and women going to get a fair trial when this has been so extensively covered in media that everybody, it always stuns me. I don't, of course, it's a little different there in Canada where you're not allowed to talk about an ongoing case until it's resolved, where here in the USA, all you got to do is go on Facebook and listen to these people with absolutely no knowledge of anything saying, I know so-and-so is guilty. I know so everyone knows they did it. Well, how do they know they did it? They haven't seen it. All they know is they saw the person's name, you know, as being a suspect or not being a suspect. Oh, I know who did it. I know who did it. Well, they'll never get on a jury, of course, with that attitude.
No.
But, I mean, people do win the conclusion jumping competition of the 2020 Olympics every time there's a high-profile case. Well, so they moved it, moved it out of Alaska down to San Francisco to try to, get an impartial jury, which can be difficult in any situation when there's a great deal of coverage, especially if you have someone such as, I think it was when Manson was charged, the President of the United States referred to him as being guilty before the trial. That was a little much. But you understand what I mean. So they got a change of venue. They wound up, of course, everybody being found guilty of something, and even people who were found innocent went to prison.
Yeah.
Which is sets a whole new spin on American justice.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Burl, just for a second. We're going to talk about that trial because there's some dramatic evidence put on the big screen at that trial. Again, another very movie-esque scene. We're going to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor of this program, Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Let Blue Apron do the meal prep for you, making back to school easier than ever. Dinner in as little as 20 minutes. Quick and easy recipes with insanely delicious flavors. Perfectly portioned ingredients delivered right to your door. Chef design recipes and exciting September partnerships like Bob's Burger inspired and Whole30 approved. Now, I tried the Whole30 approved, the spice crusted salmon and carrot fries with avocado kale salad and chipotle dipping sauce. I was just interested just in the description. This was very easy, straightforward recipe, and voila, fantastic meal made by me. What a unique, amazing combination of flavors I felt.
This recipe, again, was approved by Whole30. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/murder. That's blueapron.com/murder to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, Burl, tell us a little bit about what I alluded to was the dramatic prosecution showing a photo of the couple, Michelle, and two photos. So tell us about the two photos that almost made somebody
One of the jurors almost vomited in the courtroom because it was just so horrifying. First, they put up a picture of David and Michelle's wedding, their wedding picture, you know, their happy, smiling faces on their wedding day. And then they cut directly to a picture of his totally mangled, burnt corpse and her melted face. And it was so horrifying and graphic that one of the jurors had to be restrained himself from actually vomiting right there in the courtroom.
Yeah. You have also that his behavior in, well, actually, we'll talk about Doug Gustafson. We got to go back a little bit to both of these people's behavior. Doug Gustafson and then later Raymond Cheely, Smiley Cheely, didn't have the smile on his face when he went to trial. But let's first talk about Doug Gustafson readily admits what he did.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us why you think he did that, and what exactly did he say about that?
Well, first of all, he said that if people would have followed his directions, if they would have done things the way he wanted it done, David and Michelle would be alive today. He only wanted to kill little George, and he has no plans to send any more bombs. But he was proud of the work he did in getting that mail bomb ready and instructing Peggy. And he felt bad that that David was killed, and he felt bad that Michelle had her face melted and her eyes filled with glass. That wasn't part of the plan. No, the plan, the way he wanted, was George gets killed. George didn't get killed, and these two, in his mind, innocent people did, and he said he felt really bad about that. So, as you may know, this bizarre twist in the tale here is that Doug Gustafson teamed up with Michelle to sue the state for negligence in not stopping the mail bomb.
Right. Incredible.
He felt sorry for her, and he wanted to cost the state a lot of money. But the adding more tragedy to this story, insurance had offered her a settlement of, I think it was, $2 million. She didn't feel that was enough, and I think she was right. But when they went to court, there was judgments against the state, judgments against Cheely, judgments against Gustafson, judgment against Ryan, who was quite wonderful how the hell he wound up in all this, and that the state was only responsible for 12% of the total cost, which came out by the time he got done with legal fees and one thing and another. She got less than the $2 million she would have got if she would have just taken the deal with the insurance company.
Yeah,
so she broke down in tears right there in the courtroom, and even though she won, she didn't win anything. And that was even more tragic. You know, it was not one thing, it's something else. Doug Gustafson said he wanted to cost him millions of dollars. And so the state added the Gustafson, Cheely, and Ryan as co-defendants to share the cost should she win her case. Well, she did, but they didn't have any money, of course. And so that meant she got, as my father would say, Hickok's bottle of vinegar. She didn't get anything, you know, next to nothing.
Yeah. You talk about July 15th, 92, because the Department of Justice decides to go for the death penalty for Raymond Cheely. And July 15th, 1992, Craig pleads guilty. Craig Gustafson pleads guilty to mailing the bomb or being involved with the bomb and testifies against Ryan and Raymond Cheely. And for this deal, he gets 22 and a half years.
You talk about also jailhouse informants and their importance in this. What
were the
jailhouse
informants?
The
prosecution dragged out prison informants so crooked they couldn't lie straight in bed. And these guys would change the stories with disconcerting rapidity. And when they were confronted with their dishonesty, it didn't seem to bother them. One of them testified under oath that Cheely was involved in activity. The simple fact check showed that he wasn't even there at the time. And so they, you know, the jailhouse informants are not exactly reliable witnesses. But I think what really did it was the pictures, which I would imagine the defense probably objected to the prosecution showing those pictures, as it would have so much of an emotional impact. But the facts of the matter were still fairly clear. One error that prosecutors make, I've noticed, and I'm sure they notice it too, or maybe they don't because they're not true crime writers. Maybe we have the blessing of being, you know, a little farther removed sense of perspective, is going for, the typical one, is going for a common scheme or plan when it isn't, and that blows up in their face, or trotting out unreliable witnesses, paid informants, and people with no veracity to them whatsoever, that instead of bolstering the prosecution's case, makes them look like they're desperate by bringing out all sorts of people who lie on the witness stand, and blatantly so. I don't think that's ever a good idea. If your case is strong enough, it's not a matter of do you think you can win it. This is, I don't know about up in Canada, but the United States, it's not so much a system of true justice in most cases. It's can we win it, whether the person's guilty or not? Can we win it? And that becomes the contest. I think we can win this one. Not, you know, then that's not what the prosecutors, people think it's the prosecution's job to prosecute people. It's not. It's to prosecute justice, to get justice done. If the person's not the one, you know, it doesn't matter if you can build the case. Is it true? It's really a difficult situation. I'm sure you're aware of the one in, and I had the woman on my show, too. Maybe you had her on as well. She wrote a book about a case in San Diego where the woman was convicted of poisoning her husband with arsenic and then using some of the insurance money to get a boob job and having sex with every Marine in San Diego. Well, not every, but every other. She was innocent, but they found her guilty because they were able to push this thing through with enough smoke and mirrors, and they won it on appeal, however. The arsenic evidence experts came forward and said, I told them she didn't do it. But they said they could win it anyway. They'd be, you know, true crime book as heroes for, you know, sending this woman away. Finally, it was allowed that the woman could sue the San Diego prosecutors for $12 million, which she did, bless her heart. So, you know, some of the desire to be partially famous in a true crime book by being the winning prosecutor, if you're prosecuting people who didn't do it, there's no glory there.
You write in the book, though, that Peggy and Craig Gustafson both were testified at trial against Raymond Cheely and Ryan, and then Craig is now has an assumed identity and is in witness protection in prison. So there was clearly, whether they gave him that evidence or he was gave them the evidence that they needed for the prosecution. And when you talk about, again, another movie-esque scene in this is that Raymond Cheely's response when he gets sentenced. Tell us about what happens at the trial in terms of guilt or innocence, and then what does Raymond Cheely do in response to the sentence?
Well, I was there in person for the sentencing. I flew up to Alaska and because I was working on the book back then, you know, 20-some years ago, mm-hmm. as a guest of the U.S. Postal Inspectors, who, I cannot compliment enough on how gracious they were to me and continue to be. I think if I ever get in trouble, I'll call them.
Yeah.
Help me out, you guys. I did a book about you.
Yes.
And I was there when Michelle gave her, you know, victim's impact statement, and she
right.
just gave them hell. I mean, how they destroyed her life, their face, her vision, her future, her husband, her home. And Raymond laughed. He didn't just smile. He laughed. Well, I'm sure it was a nervous laugh. What's he got to be amused about? He's going to be sent off, you know. And he's already in prison for murder. What else are they going to do to him?
Sure.
You know? Like, there was a counterfeiting case that I was informed about, where they were looking for this master counterfeiter, and they finally found him in prison. What are you going to do? Send him home? What do you do when the criminal you catch is already in prison?
Yeah. You talk about Peggy's sentence, 24 years and 4 months.
I wonder if
but
she's out
talking about
now.
Her husband. Pardon me?
Wait, is she out now? Has it been 24 years and 6 months?
Could be. It is, yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah, she's probably working down at Walmart.
Wow. Her husband, Dennis, didn't have anything to do with this, did he?
No, he had absolutely nothing to do, and he was disgusted by the entire concept. I mean, you know, it's upsetting enough to have your spouse may be having an affair with the local grocery clerk or the pool boy. Of course, you don't have pool boys in Alaska. I guess they have ice boys because the pool freezes over. But to find out that your wife was joyously committing murder in one of the most heinous, disgusting crimes in Alaskan history, you're not going to be amused by that at all. I mean, he announced that he was getting a divorce. He didn't want to stay married to her. I don't think he didn't want to be faithful to her for 24 years and 6 months while she languished in prison for the horrible murder that she helped take place. And it weighed on her. I mean, I don't know how much it would have weighed on her for the killing of the person she wanted to kill, which was George, a contemporary, the only guy with the ethics practically in this whole story, except maybe for Craig. And Joseph, who was innocent of everything and yet did all the time in prison. Mayberry told me that he saw her after she'd been in prison a while, and he could see that it was eating her alive. You know, the what she had done, the pain and suffering and death and destruction that she had participated in, I'm sure had a negative effect on her self-image. You know, it's hard to think well of yourself. And it wasn't that she accidentally fell into it like a clean kid into a coal chute. She joyously participated in what she envisioned as the horrifying murder of George Carr, when instead it was the horrifying murder of George's father and the complete disfiguration of his stepmother.
Was Michelle present when they flashed the photo of her wedding and then of the crime scene? Was she there to witness that?
I don't know the answer to that one, Dan. I was not in the courtroom for the trial. I was only there for the sentencing and the victim's impact statement. But I can't imagine that she'd be there. I can't imagine that. If I was her, I wouldn't want to see that. She was lucky if she could see anything, and she was mostly blind, too. She still had glass in her eyes long after this had happened. I mean, she's standing in the kitchen when this explosion went. It was amazing that she was able to say Doug Gustafson, you know, when I pulled, that she knew who would have been behind it. That's how much Doug hated her stepson. But, I mean, there was virtually nothing left of her. Her face was gone. She was blind. Her eardrums exploded. really severe.
Yeah. And you saw, was she there at the sentencing? Well, obviously she was there.
Yeah,
she made the impact statement. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah,
so
the whole thing was fairly horrible, and she had, you know, dark glasses and face kind of covered. I mean, what do you do in that situation? It was through no fault of her own that she was so horribly disfigured. I mean, God only. I mean, I've got a friend of mine who was held captive by some guy that should have known better, but it was drunk and disorderly. He beat her face in. And took $10,000 worth of surgery on her face to reconstruct it. I saw her the day after she got away from this guy, and she'd just been beaten. And what her face looked like then, and then the surgery. And, I mean, now she actually looks better than she did before. The way they gave her a nice new face, it's not the face she started with. I can't relate to the emotional despair that someone could go through in that kind of terrible situation. I mean, it's just beyond my, I can sympathize, but I can't empathize. I just can't imagine how awful that would be.
Yeah. Well, you talked about Michelle's bills at that time that had accumulated by the time of that civil trial at $400,000. So
over $400,000 medical expenses.
Incredible.
And that was what, 1990?
Yeah.
Put that in 2018 dollars, and it's, you know, well over $1 million. What, $1.5 million?
Well, what it seemed is that even though of the $400,000, they were not ending. I mean, there was more surgeries to go. There was more work to do. Obviously.
Yeah, it was.
Hence the disappointment with the settlement too. The settlement was
You won the case, and you get less than what we offered you in the first place.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, you talk about how big the media response was to this, how far-reaching it was in terms of people being interested in this story. How did they portray this story? And just tell us a little bit more about the media and its response.
Well, you got to figure, what is the population of Alaska relative to anywhere else, and how many media outlets do they have? Well, you've got the Anchorage newspaper, probably got the Chugiak Shopping News, you've got your network affiliates. And when I was up there, I think the biggest news was that there was a bear walked into JCPenney's. That's the thing that surprised me so much about Anchorage, is that it's smaller than Spokane, Washington. Now, I was at the prosecutor's office. They were really great, too, meeting with the federal prosecutor there. And then I got my rental car, and I was driving to the home of one of the U.S. Postal Inspectors. And I got to tell you, it was summertime, and it was gorgeous up there, and the sun never set. It always looked like it was dusk. When the sun went down, it didn't go down. It was like 7 o'clock at night, dusk, my favorite time of day, all night. And they'd been out hunting, and they were making reindeer meatballs, as a matter of fact. You know, there's no deer in Alaska. There's just reindeer.
Okay.
I went to drive to this guy's house. I kind of spaced out. Next thing I knew, I'm out in the middle of nowhere. Bam, I was out of town that fast. You think you're in a capital city, it's going to have some streets to it. But it's a small town, and everything else is smaller. So when you've got a major story like this, it saturates everything. It saturates every radio broadcast, every TV broadcast, every print run of the newspaper, and individuals' conversations. And the majority of those conversations were recorded with federal wiretaps.
Wow. Yeah. You do single out, and the U.S. Postal Service Inspection Service is really happy to be able to work with you to highlight the work that they did do. And it was impressive, as you say, the budget that they have and the technology that is available to them, but also as a investigative arm of the government. And I didn't realize their importance, and as a result, what they have in place in case they need the investigative services of the U.S. Postal team. So hence this task force was put together with a lot of people, a lot of investigators, and a lot of emphasis and no constraints in terms of budget for this, did they?
No, I mean, this was top priority, and everybody cooperated with everybody else. There weren't any game playing, power trips, you know, boundaries, barriers. In fact, they gave the Inspector of the Year award to the Chief of Police of Anchorage,
right,
who wasn't part of the federal team because it was so cooperative. It was, I mean, that's the kind of dedication you had. This crime was so horrific and so threatening that, I mean, you stop and think about it. We all go to, you know, pick up our mail every day and shuffle through the bills and the junk mail and don't bother to think about it. We don't think about someone destroying our home, murdering our wives, husbands, children, whatever, at the mail. And so in the United States, when you put a letter in the mailbox to go out, it is no longer your property. It then becomes the property of the United States government until it's delivered. And so if someone's messing with it, you got big problems. And the next case that I wanted to do, the post inspector turned me on to, which was absolutely fascinating, but no publisher wants it because no one's murdered, was, and I'll just take a minute to tell you this, I think you'll find it interesting as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
A lady writes a letter to the postal inspector and says, boy, I'm really mad. I paid $12 for a classified ad in a paper to how to figure out my winning lottery numbers. And I was going to get, you know, Dr. Schmendrick's secret lottery, you know, whatever. But I never got it. Well, that's a violation of postal law. Not selling how to win the lottery, but not, if you're charging someone $12, you better deliver it.
Sure.
And so they noticed that the P.O. box that you were supposed to mail was in some other ads as well. And as you may know, it's against the law in America to buy tickets in foreign lotteries. If you're having a lottery in Canada,
sure,
American citizens, we can't buy a Canadian lotto ticket.
No.
Well, there was this guy who would target widowers and widows who had just lost their spouse and befriend them on the phone and convince them to buy foreign lottery tickets and then tell them that they'd won and wanted to reinvest the money in more tickets. And I'm sending you a form to sign to make that easy for you. And the form was a power of attorney over all their bank accounts. And he looped them of every cent they ever had.
Wow.
And he was doing it out of Canada, where it was a misdemeanor.
Wow.
And they finally got this guy. He was in India or something. He had several million dollars stashed in Seattle Bank. They were able to seize that. But his total punishment for this most heartless of crimes, in which he was making millions and millions of dollars looting these people, these elderly people's life savings, is he did, I think it was 18 months minimum security in a federal prison, and then was released, and he had millions stashed all over the world. The only way they were getting it was civil judgments against him by Ireland, I think, went after him for $33 million. The UK went after him for, I think, an equal amount. Whether they got it or not, I don't know. But can you imagine how heartless someone would be to do that? And he wasn't doing it alone. He had another woman, another guy working with him, befriending these lonely, sad people who just lost their husband or wife, and then robbing them of everything.
Sure. Well, it's an example of people taking advantage of the most vulnerable, and we see that in these murder cases all the time. I mean, they're mad at the world, so they take it out on somebody else that has been victimized by society.
Yeah, they say the people, these like bullies. A friend of mine is running this campaign, you know, stop bullying. I say bullies don't care to be told to stop bullying. Who's going to stop it? Bullies don't care. Because all bullies are afraid. It's a fear response. They were bullied. They were abused. And when they see someone weak, it triggers that whole fear response of when they were weak. And just, that's the thing, if they're asking for it, you see that person was asking for it because that's what they were told, that being weak is asking for it. That's a tragic situation. Until we stop the whole thing of abusing each other, we'll have bullies.
Yeah. What's interesting in this book, whereas in a full-length book, we would get a little bit more of, I'm just curious, because we never mentioned there was a person named Robert Chamberlain was the person driving the truck that passed Raymond Cheely and Gustafson, and they decided he had cut them off. So Jeffrey Kane, as we mentioned, was the passenger that was shot in the back of the head. You don't really mention, but it would be very interesting to know the fate of Robert Chamberlain and what he felt
it
after this.
And you are absolutely correct. If this had been a larger book, and it is available as an audio book standalone, and it's available in print in the book Masters of True Crime, edited by R. Barry Flowers, I would have followed up on that for sure. There'd be a lot more about the investigation. I wanted to put in a picture of the agent who listened to all the hours of the tapes,
right?
And they said no because he works undercover a lot.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And they didn't want his picture. Hold on a second. I have to not answer this call.
Well, it's a theme of true crime uncensored, so that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's the theme from The Saint,
Let's talk about your incredible true crime podcast.
It's a strange thing. You've been doing these podcasts. You were much hipper to it than I ever was in terms of how to build that audience. I can remember calling you up and saying, how do I get this thing on iTunes? I couldn't figure it out. Yeah. But along came Anchor FM, who did what Mixcloud, these other places, or Blog Talk didn't do, and that is they take care of all of that. Bless their little hearts. I do my show, which is live Saturdays at 2:00 on OutlawRadioLive.com, and Douglas Shearer has been recording it for me every week dutifully for the past couple of years. Although I think this coming week is his last hit recording. I get someone else. I simply upload it to Anchor FM, and they upload it to every podcast platform that exists: iTunes, Google Play, this one, that one. I don't have to mess with it, which was driving me nuts. So it's interesting to look at the listenership just on the podcast, not at the live audience, because that's really hard to judge. We know on our old server the thing would blow up when we got to 250,000, which it seldom blew up, but we got a new server on that. But since it went up on iTunes and the other stuff, I can watch every week. It just goes higher and higher and higher and higher. And what's interesting to me is what episodes get the largest number of downloads. Hmm. And ironically, the person who was calling me just now was Leonard Bushell, who is a former drug smuggler who now produces the Real Recovery Film Festivals. He founded Writers in Treatment, which is similar to Music Cares, and the founder originally as a nonprofit with Robert Downey, to provide financial aid and treatment to people working in the writing and publishing industry who may have problems with drug, alcohol, or other behavioral problems, and they don't have insurance. And he produces the Experience, Strength, and Hope Awards. And we did an interview with him a year ago October, November, about the upcoming Real Recovery Film Festival. And with everything else, that still remains our most downloaded episode.
Interesting. Yeah.
And maybe it's because it says drug smuggler retired. I think people want to hear about drug smugglers.
Yeah.
But it's not most. And, of course, we have our friend Punch, Pavle Stanimirovic, the world's second greatest diamond thief. His father's number one because his dad never got caught, never went to prison. He, unfortunately or fortunately, did get caught. That's kind of interesting. People say, well, how did he get caught? Well, he got caught twice, once because he made a mistake, and the second time because someone in the same building as the diamond heist was taking place. It was like a gemstone manufacturing place, you know, not a private home. He never did that. It was like,
right,
you know, commercial place. But there were apartments in the same buildings, and this guy went nuts and decapitated the family cat, the family parakeet, and the family father, and threw his father's head out in the middle of the street.
Wow.
So he had homicide trying to catch this guy. In the process of trying to catch him, they run in where Punch and his buddy are doing this multi-million-dollar diamond heist. And they go, oh, me, man, we were just in here trying to find a safe place to smoke a joint. They tried to pull
wow.
that one.
Yeah.
That's so you never know what weird thing's going to happen. You know, it's like... Oh, did you ever see this Stanley Kramer, Cooper? I always get the two confused. Kramer film, The Killing, starring Sterling Hayden.
No.
It's a heist movie. It's a racetrack robbery. And they plan it down to the last little detail. And things, when if things can go wrong, it doesn't take much.
No.
You know? And it's a great, great film if you get a chance to watch it. They couldn't remake it today because the way the restrictions are on getting on airplanes, you can't just go, you know, grab a ticket and get on. But
right.
That was back in the old days when it was still like America, in America.
Every week you and Howard Lapidus, producer and manager Howard Lapidus, have, and before that, when I was had great honor of being on your show the first time with Don Waldman, you have had almost a similar format to True Murder in that you have live interviews, and so you you get some fascinating stuff when it's live and it's not edited and it's not a couple guys just sitting around talking about a crime. You're talking to the people very much like I do, the people that are the authorities, the authors, the people that were there, the people that are
or the criminals,
the integral part of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, not too many people tackle the criminals. I think we had an exclusive. We had... a guy that Punch, the diamond heist guy, introduced me to in Florida, who was in the Russian mob. And we got along famously over dinner. And I said, would you come on my show? And he agreed. I think I'm the first person to have someone from the Russian mob. You know, there were some things he wouldn't talk about because it would get him killed. But the things he would talk about, like how he wound up in the Russian mob and why he was in it and everything else, was a coup. You know,
we
never
absolutely.
Know what things are going to come your way. And, Ron Chepsek, who also does a true crime show. He was on, he says, bragging, of course, away, as he well should about his show and why you should about yours. He says, you guys don't really do a true crime show. You do a comedy show that happens to be about true crime. Well, he's partially correct for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And maybe a little later. But we get into some serious stuff, you know.
You guys are the originator. You're the originator, though, of adding some levity to murder, basically, to true crime. And some of your guests are humorous, but Howard and yourself and Don, just to a great degree, it's a fun show. It's got levity where you wouldn't expect. And now it seems like a lot of the podcasts, that's the format. So you're in many ways the originator.
Well, you
got to
figure that I've been doing this show for over 10 years on the internet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's internet years. You know, it's like dog years.
Yes.
That's a long time to have a show that's on every Saturday, 2:00 Pacific time, OutlawRadioLive.com for over 10 years. And the reason it wound up being a true crime show wasn't my brilliant idea. Matt Allen said, who used to work with me at KYYX in Seattle, said, Burroughs, why don't you do a show on LR Radio? Why don't you do an hour before me? You just got to figure out what you want to do. Well, one of the LR Radio listeners said, well, you write true crime books. Why don't you do a true crime show? Well, I didn't want to do it by myself because I like having someone to bounce things off of. And right in front of me was Don Waldman, family law attorney, but he had a brilliant man with great experience.
Absolutely.
And I said, hey, you want to do a true crime show? He said, I'd love to do a true crime show. And we had the best time doing it. We really did. And he had to take a hiatus because of some legal obligations, and Howard stepped in to fill in for him. And then after about a year or so, Don said, I feel bad if I come back if I don't want to take Howard out of the chair because he's, you know, he's in there now. But Don would come back and fill in, or he'd come back and join us on occasion. And then, of course, when he died so suddenly, we were all just completely shocked. A great guy, and he was a joy to work with. And I'll be putting a lot of the old Don Waldman shows up on the iTunes and everywhere so people can enjoy that. I think one of the most emotionally shocking shows I ever participated in was the first one you did about the Shall We Dance murders. That was so shocking. I mean, that's an incredible book. I'm not just, you know, blowing smoke here. That is, I think, one of the most gripping true crime books I've ever read. And the guy is so twisted. Did it mess with your head? I'm going to interview you now. Did it mess with your head to deal with that guy?
Well, absolutely. And as you know, too, why, you know, coming from you, it's great praise because all I really did was, inspired by authors like yourself, I was able to ask the questions. I read books like Broken Doll, and I've read books from you over the years, true crime classics. And from that, you get an understanding of that psychopathic mind. So certainly I had read some of these things coming to life talking to this guy, that from these true crime books, these classics, I could understand the kind of mind that this person was, and he was influenced by the kinds of murderers and killers that you and other great
authors write
about all
the time.
Yeah, he
wanted to be the number one most horrible killer in Canadian history. This is his goal.
Well, he's got some competition, but that was his goal. Yes, his goal was he was very competitive. Yeah.
Yeah, he certainly was. Absolutely. I mean, it was just shocking to me the things he's like, I've got a great idea what I'll do to this corpse. I mean, that guy was, words can't describe him. You did a fine job with him. I was unnerved enough when I went and spoke to Rhonda Glover in prison for Fatal Beauty. And when I came out of there and I got back in the car in Texas, my daughter said, don't worry, Dad. She can't come out of there and come get you. She's going to be in there for another 60 years or something. And I didn't realize it was so obvious that it affected me, that when I came out of the prison, she could tell that I was bothered. But you're right. You know, when you know you're dealing with psychopaths, which is a step beyond sociopaths, you're dealing with people that cannot see beyond themselves. They are the center of the universe, and reality is at their whim, that they can make up anything, say anything, and it's just like they're creating the universe as they go along. And facts and information have little or no importance to them whatsoever. And they do not have the ability to feel the pain of others, and it's psychologically or emotionally. And it doesn't matter. Carve a turkey, carve a person, same difference.
Well,
but you know, people think I'm kidding about this. There is a support website for sociopaths.
Wow.
And I can't recall what it's called, sociopath.org or something like that. But it's actually maintained by sociopaths as a public service for other sociopaths. And they didn't like a short story I wrote called Giving Shoulder, which was written from the standpoint of a psychopath, actually. And they didn't like it. But that's okay. I can't please everybody. You can't please every sociopath. but there was some interesting, like, letters to the editor statements in there. They acknowledge this one sociopath says, okay, everything they say about us is true. We only think about ourselves. We're incapable of thinking about anybody else. And so I realize that if I do all these really sick things that other sociopaths do and rip people off, that it's not that, gee, I don't want to cause other people problems. It's it'll cause me problems. And I'm the only person that's important to me. And being as I don't want to have problems like going to prison or being, you know, treated poorly, I'm not going to do that stuff. Now, they're not doing it. Now, he's not behaving because he has a moral code that says, I care about others and don't want to hurt them. It's, I care about me and me alone, and if I do these things, I'll be unhappy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they say that if you could get to a sociopath or a psychopath before the age of 14, you can teach them that. But once they get in the system, it's really hard, really difficult.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that Peter Vronsky, Sons of Cain, just recently described in his book that the psychopath can intellectually understand the feeling that he's supposed to have, but yet cannot feel it physically or psychologically. But he understands it. So the danger is that whether he's saying he was, you know, maybe abused when he was a child, there's always an excuse. There's always a blame. There's always that narcissistic focus that they're, you know, they even want to be liked and loved by the police. So we never really know what the truth is with a psychopath, even when they are being candid. And because they can to fool, want to play, think that they're smarter at every stage of their life,
they
even
always,
if it's just killing
a vulnerable person. That's just the first sign of the psychopath is they'll become their own defense attorney.
Sure.
Notice
absolutely.
That?
Yeah.
That's
or
how
they'll
huge their ego
the stand.
Is.
Or they'll take the stand when they shouldn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's like the situation we have down here in the United States right now on whether our current president should do an interview with the investigating committee. And even his own attorney said,
no.
Well, we don't want any perjury traps. Perjury is lying under oath.
Sure.
You know, it's like acknowledging that the individual has a marked proclivity for making things up. And you can't do that when you're being interviewed by the FBI. That's a crime. And if, you know, if you just can't, it's like, you know, it's your nature. If you can't resist it, you know, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, he would be well advised, as most people are, to let their attorney handle things. Certainly.
Yeah, because even if the person is innocent of any wrongdoing, if their natural tendency is just to make stuff up on the fly, that's just going to hurt them, even if they've done nothing wrong. You know, I mean,
well, that was,
you just don't do that.
Yeah, that was the case of the Happy Face killer. There was a woman first came forward and then said it was her and her husband, and the courts were so convinced, because she was flukily right on some things that she shouldn't have known, and she was confessed and did confess and was convicted of a murder that the Happy Face killer Jesperson committed. And then bizarrely his lawyer said, it's the only time I ever had to fight to prove that my client was guilty of a crime. So,
yeah. No kidding. Well, then
yeah,
you got the one where
you
got to get to tell me more about a delicious recipe.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. I like that last one. That was made me hungry.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a situation where an attorney here in the U.S. knew that his client intentionally sent an innocent person to prison for a crime that he did, and he thought it was hysterically funny.
Wow.
And he would not allow his attorney to let anybody know that an innocent person had been in prison all these years until he died, if he died first.
Incredible. Well, like criminals, there are some people without any moral or ethical standards or...
See, that's
know.
Always the problem, is I assume people have at least some standards similar to mine. Not that mine are that exalted, but at least they're, you know, they seem fairly rational to me. You know, what was it, the line that from The Big Chill, you know, justifications are, you know, are the most important thing. More important, justifications are more important than sex. After all, can you go a week without a justification?
Well, if you talk about the courts, though, and you talk about a prosecutor, and you do write about this, and you are a journalist that's fair and balanced, you say sometimes a prosecutor just wants to win. So why wouldn't everyone, you know, go by those standards? So.
Well, because that's not what they take an oath to do.
Sure. Well, that's it.
And then they get elected. They run on how many convictions they got. That's really sick.
Yes,
I don't like that idea. You know, how many times did I win? You know, right or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's tied in with political. Unlike Canada, it's tied in so heavily with politics that it's political rather than judicial. And so you have problems inherent right with that system.
Right. We have a court system in the United States. We don't have a justice system.
Yeah. Well, don't look now. Canada has different problems, but serious, serious problems. Anyway, Burl, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the Alaska mail bomb conspiracy.
Conversations. And we're going to have you back pretty soon.
Absolutely. I just wanted to mention again, this is originally from Masters of True Crime, Chilling Stories of Murder in the Macabre, edited by Arbery Flowers, and your story is in that. And but now is available as a standalone audiobook and available everywhere, I guess. Tell us a little bit about where we might be able to get that.
It was done by listenupaudiobooks.com. You get it direct from them. Or if you go to Audible and you don't have a membership yet and you sign up, you can get that one for free. So it's a heck of a deal. Oh. Also, Mom Said Kill is also now available as an audio book for the first time. And it just came out as an audio book. And you can get that free, too, if you want. If you don't have an account at Audible, you sign up, you can get a free audio book. And more than welcome to pick one of mine.
Absolutely.
Because I enjoy listening to the audio book of the Alaska mail bomb conspiracy. We went on a long drive, and I listened to it in the car, and I thought the guy did a great job narrating it. So I was very,
absolutely,
very pleased.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Burl, and make sure for people to remind them of True Crime Uncensored every Saturday at 4 o'clock, is it?
No, it's 2 o'clock Pacific time, 5 o'clock East Coast time, 10 o'clock U.K., if you're where would you be? In Pakistan, it's exactly 12 hours later. We do have listeners in Pakistan, so instead of being on at 2 in the afternoon, it's on at 2 in the morning. the day after, or the next day, or something. I don't know. That it gets very confusing when you cross the international date lines.
Absolutely. Thank you once again, Burl. You have a great evening, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
I look forward to listening to this. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.